This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, is the deeply divided U.S. Congress about to pass major infrastructure reform in a bipartisan way? Then, eating fermented foods like kimchi and kombucha may do more for your gut than a high-fiber diet. Also, why teachers are more likely to see anger in a black student's expressions and behavior, even when it's not there. That's all coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. Before the chaotic exit from Afghanistan cast a shadow over the Biden administration, President Biden was celebrating a bipartisan victory on his infrastructure priorities in the Senate.
For the Republicans who supported this bill, you showed a lot of courage. And I want to personally thank you for that. And I've called most of you on the phone to do just that. You have, and no doubt you will, disagree with me on many issues. But where we can agree, we should. And here on this bill, we prove that we can still come together to do big things, important things for the American people.
Just how bipartisan was that victory? And what about all of the things that were left out of the bill so Republicans would support it? Political scientist James Curry is on the line from the University of Utah, where he's a professor. He's a former congressional staffer and author of several books about how things get done in Washington. Professor Curry, welcome back. It's nice to speak with you.
Thanks for having me again.
Why did Senate Republicans vote to support anything that President Biden wanted to see done?
Well, this is in some ways a very classic case of the majority party backing down on something that the other party is interested in doing something on. And this is probably the most common way that bipartisanship actually occurs in these days in Washington. In other words, the majority party proposes something really far-reaching, some ambitious proposal, but on a topic where there's general agreement that both parties want to do something. But that ambitious proposal certainly does not have the votes to pass. It may not even have the votes to pass within one party. And so it slowly backs down and negotiates away the more controversial aspects of what it wants to do until it secures enough support for what's left. With this bill, with this bipartisan infrastructure bill, this involved not just negotiating with a cohort of Senate Republicans, but also with some more moderate Senate Democrats who not only are but still are uncomfortable with some of the more ambitious proposals coming from the rest of the party. But these are folks who also saw some value in building broader support behind these physical or traditional infrastructure programs that had the real ability to garner bipartisan support.
So what Senate Republicans and Democrats were able to agree on sufficient to pass this bill include what? We're talking traditional. You mentioned the word traditional. So it's money for roads and bridges.
Yeah,
and
roads, bridges, electricity, some broadband, things that people think about as like hard traditional, the things people think about when they actually say infrastructure, pipes, things made of asphalt, that kind of stuff, which is important stuff, but it's not all the stuff that Democrats had originally talked about.
Like what? So what did Democrats have to give up in order to get this bill passed?
They had to give up on a lot of sort of the social welfare programming, education programming, healthcare programming, support for families, paid leave, caregiver support, universal pre-K, expansions to the Affordable Care Act, all these sort of things that they were labeling as infrastructure and that they're framing as infrastructure, because infrastructure is generally a good word with positive vibes. These are things that people don't think about in the same way they think about as roads. And these are things where you're more likely to find sharper divisions in Washington about how the federal government should approach them.
But when President Biden talked about his infrastructure plan and launched it, you know, sort of pitched it to the American people, it was all about, I mean, it was equally, if not more, about those other things you just described as it was about roads and bridges and pipes. I mean, it was about we need to have more money for parents and for childcare and supporting American families. And this was talked about as like the largest expansion of the social safety net in America since like the New Deal. Right. And he was leaning into that messaging. So is this really a victory for him if they gave up all that stuff in order to get Republicans to pass this scaled back version of more traditional infrastructure?
This is exactly why parties in Washington have trouble claiming victories, because these days the parties in Washington are inclined to, including presidents, inclined to make these really sweeping proposals. I mean, the original proposal that the Biden administration was putting out there, this like big, like universal infrastructure plan, is basically just everything the Democratic Party and major factions of the Democratic Party would ever want to do. It's everything.
from social services to climate change related stuff. It's like all in there. Okay.
It's a generation of like policy proposals. And parties do this because it gets their voters and their supporters all excited. Yes, this is why we support the Democratic Party. This is why we voted for Joe Biden. This is what we want to see. But the downside of that is certainly never going to happen. And it's certainly never going to happen in one bill or one fell swoop. So then it feels underwhelming when they actually get to the end and you see what's left. This is a constant problem for parties these days, is that they have a tendency to overpromise and then underdeliver, leaving their own voters somewhat dissatisfied with what is actually produced, even if it's something substantial. This is a pretty substantial, large, long-term infrastructure bill, which is something the country has needed for years and that the Congress has not been able to get behind. But when you see all the stuff that got left out, left on the floor, it feels a little underwhelming.
What hope then do Democrats have to get that other stuff? If they couldn't get it included in a bill that would clear the Senate without getting filibustered, I mean, what do they do with all that other stuff they had to leave on the cutting room floor?
Their plan for the moment is to try to pass as much of it as they can through what's called budget reconciliation, which is a somewhat, I don't want to say archaic, but somewhat convoluted congressional process that allows a simple majority in the Senate, that is a majority that is not subject to any sort of filibusters, to pass some things without the other party or anyone really being able to block it.
So this is a loophole.
As long as they have 50 votes.
This is a loophole around the filibuster.
Yeah, it's an unintended loophole. This was something that was put in place in the budget acts of the early 1970s, where Congress was trying to reclaim some of its budgetary powers from the presidency. They put in this procedure by which Congress could quickly and in an expedited way fast track a bill that would either to put the budget back into balance, to deal with budget deficits, or to spend budget surpluses without having to go through the long, laborious process that they have to the rest of the time. And that way Congress could act quick and they wouldn't be just giving it over to the president to make these quick decisions. Mm. Unfortunately, whenever you create a process, people are creative and they'll find a way to use it for their own purposes. And so what's happened with this procedure is that rather than be used that way, which it was a couple times early on, it's largely been used as a tool that majority parties in Washington, when they have unified control of Washington, realize they can use to pass some of their more ambitious one-party proposals that just don't have any support on the other side.
They can do it with anything they want. They're just like,
no.
Oh, we'll just use the loophole for this.
No, and that's where the catch comes in. It's one of the catches. That's the big procedural catch. It's because this is a budgetary procedure, there's essentially a rule that everything that's in it has to be of, I mean, a way to think about it is that it has the primary budgetary purpose. So the budgetary impact of the thing they want to pass cannot be secondary to what it's doing, which is why a lot of things just simply can't be done this way. And why something like a minimum wage increase, which is something that the Democrats tried to include in the American Rescue Plan, which also passed via budget reconciliation, was stripped out by the Senate parliamentarian because a minimum wage increase does not have a primary or predominant budgetary purpose.
Meaning that, I mean, it has a purpose for my budget if I am on
yeah.
the minimum wage. But
means
like
for your budget, but not for the federal government's budget. Its primary purpose is to raise wages.
Okay, but
right?
it's not a policy thing, not an outlay or a cut somehow to the budget of the federal government.
So those things are not supposed to be included. Any member of the Senate can move to strike something that may not be under the rules, and the Senate mm-hmm. parliamentarian gets to rule on that, and then those things are stripped.
Is the Senate parliamentarian a Democrat?
The Senate parliamentarian is hired by both parties. So mm-hmm. she is a bipartisan official who's well-respected in Washington and who's considered an expert on these procedures. And so there's a, you know, you could ignore the parliamentarian's advice. A simple majority of senators could disagree and overturn the parliamentarian's ruling. But now you're getting into a situation where you've hired this person to enforce the rules, and now you're going to ignore them when you don't feel like enforcing the rules. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of hesitancy to just do that and then have to deal with the consequences later.
So what are the prospects then for Democrats getting the other big stuff that Republicans will not get on board for? What are the prospects of Democrats being able to get that stuff all through? You know, we're talking like trillions of dollars in spending and paying for it with tax increases on a certain sector of the population, the very highest earners, according to at least the stated plans. You know, can they do that? Is it just sort of smooth sailing? And that's why they were comfortable sort of stripping it all out of the bill that went through the Senate. Yeah.
I think their hopes of pulling this off in full are pretty bad. They're pretty dim because they have such slim majorities, the Democrats do, in both chambers, right? They have exactly 50 seats in the Senate, which is the exact number of votes you need to pass this. And they have only a very slight majority, I think a 4-seat majority now in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. That leaves no room for error. And we've already heard from some more moderate senators and House members that they are not on board with all of the things that might be included in the package. Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have already said that they would not support the full proposal. You have 9 moderate House Democrats who've already indicated they were not comfortable supporting the full proposal. That's enough to sink it in both chambers. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they won't pass something, but that means that they need to now deal with negotiating with their own members about what they can get Democrats behind. And that may be something. It may be something far less ambitious than what they've proposed, which tends to be the case in Congress, or it could be nothing if the whole thing blows up. Mm. So they're very unlikely to get this whole thing through the way that they're framing it right now, but they could get something.
Yeah, something that no Republican would vote for, but that they could at least get enough Democrats to vote for.
And this becomes a self-reinforcing thing because Republicans know they don't have to vote for it. It frees them up to oppose it so they can use that on the campaign trail. Oh, mm-hmm. Democrats are being reckless. They're spending all this money. They're putting us into debt. And so even if there are things in the bill that some of the Republicans would like and would support, now they're even more free to oppose it and it can pass anyway.
And is you've already alluded to the fact that this budget loophole is not the first time that lawmakers have ever used this. And, you know, it's become quite common for the majority party when they don't have enough of a majority to kind of use this to if they can get it past the parliamentarian. But is it unusual for the majority party, the Democrats in this case, to have trouble even sort of agreeing on their own kind of fundamental budget spending priorities in this?
No, not at all. I mean, one of the least well understood things about Congress and the congressional parties is that they are a lot more divided than people give them credit for. Mm. They're certainly less divided than they were a couple generations ago when you had essentially like Southern white supremacists in the Democratic Party with progressives. But it's typical that the parties don't agree on all the things they want to do. And that's simply because we have a two-party system, which means we have really diverse party coalitions. I mean, just think about it. In the Democratic Party, you have both Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Joe Manchin, who probably don't have a ton of things that they agree on. And those are extremes, but then there's a whole range of people in between them. It's actually a lot of work to build unity behind policy proposals just within the party. And it's an underrated process and an underrated part of American politics, building intra-party support. It takes a lot of hard behind-the-scenes work, which is what you're going to see Pelosi and Schumer and Biden working on over the next coming months, is trying to build support for as many of these things as they can. But they're going to have to do it among almost every single Democrat. And that really doesn't leave a whole lot of room for error when some of these Democrats were won election in districts that Trump defeated Biden in.
Mm, so that's what some of these Democrats then have in common, is that mm-hmm. they come from Trump districts. And so mm-hmm. they have to be very careful about how progressive they appear.
Yeah. And then you go too far in the other direction. Like, what if they pitch this bill to be way too moderate and all of a sudden the progressives are upset and won't want to support it because they don't think it's good enough? It's really hard to strike that balance and keep everyone on board. And that doesn't mean they won't pull it off in some respects, but it's far from a certain thing.
Now, are these two? So originally, all of this stuff we've been discussing was part of the same bill, the same proposal for infrastructure, Build Back Better and American Jobs and Families and whatever. There's these long names, aspirational names for these bills. But is there any reason that they will, have they been completely divorced now? And so the infrastructure bill is likely to just kind of sail on through because everybody agreed to it. This other thing, though, might take quite a bit longer. Or do they have to stay in tandem?
Well, some of the House Democratic leaders are trying to keep them linked as much as possible and trying to strike this agreement between, hey, moderates, you want this bipartisan bill. And so if you want that, you're going to have to stomach this budget proposal that has all
leverage.
This other stuff.
Oh,
this
internally in the Democratic Party.
But there's no guarantee that's going to work. Mm. I feel much more confident in saying that that infrastructure bill is going to pass, and it's going to pass sometime in the next month in the House, and probably without any changes from what passed in the Senate, which means it's done. This seems to be the House Democratic leadership's plan, is to try to link them so they can keep everyone together on both. But even if that happens in the House, there's no guarantee that a proposal that gets through the House is going to go anywhere in the Senate, where you have way more Democrats who are representing districts and states where some of these things are just going to be unpopular.
Speaking with Jim Curry, who's a professor of political science at the University of Utah, author of The Limits of Party, Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. Do Republicans have any levers or leverage at this point to block the budget resolution that could, you know, that will kind of sidestep the filibuster and get the spending through Congress?
Not really. I mean, they have two small things. One is by remaining universally opposed, when there might be one or two of them who find aspects of the Democrats' plan appealing. By staying universally opposed, they put more pressure on the Democrats to have to get everyone on board, which doesn't make it any easier for them. But then two, they can also be the senators on the floor who are raising objections to things included in it that technically are not allowed under budget reconciliation rules. And that can make life harder for the Democrats too, by being the ones to raise this and say, hey, this can't be in here, and having it struck.
Okay. But not a lot. So if the Democrats can really get fully enough together to get the vote, so they can get it through both houses.
Yeah. And, yes. But what's yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. Well, I mean, I just wonder kind of big picture what's at stake here for the Democrats. Is there a rush here? Do they need to do this like right now?
Yeah. I mean, they don't have to do it right this minute, but they realize that the one fundamental near law of American politics is that the president's party loses seats in Congress in their first midterm election. And when you have just a 4-seat majority in the House, that's a virtual guarantee that you're going to lose control of the House of Representatives, which means if they want to do any of these things, if they want to have any chance to do any of these things, they have to do them before the 2022 election. And from a political standpoint, the sooner the better for a lot of the more vulnerable House and Senate Democrats, because then maybe there's more time for voters to forget about that and focus on something else. And that's what the urgency is about. But they know at the very end of the day that if they don't do this by the end of 2022, they probably aren't going to get another chance to do it, because we're going to be dealing with divided government at that point.
And that means, I mean, President Biden isn't up for re-election next year. So are there long-term complications, do you think, for him?
I think there's a lot of complications for him. On one hand, he's staked his entire reputation on being this savvy legislator and deal maker. And to be sure, voters don't actually care about that sort of stuff. That's not something that really flies into their radar, but journalists care about that sort of thing. And they'll write about it. And that can create a broad sort of perception about Joe Biden as sort of not living up to expectations, which can affect at least some voters' decision-making. But then on the other side, the Democrats and Biden should be concerned about being perceived as overreaching. This was a problem that the Democrats dealt with in 2010 after passing the Affordable Care Act, which a lot of voters saw as just too much. The Democratic Party is going too far and we need to rein them back in. And so, like, in some degrees, they're sort of in trouble either way. Mm-hmm. If you push this through, you could be seen as overreaching. If you can't do it, Biden seems like maybe he's not all that he's said that he is or framed himself as. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot at stake politically here, on top of what's at stake for their actual policy goals, the things they actually want to see done to the country.
You're an insider, having been a congressional staffer, written a lot of books, you research Congress, you think about it, you're a professor of it. If it's possible for you to step back just one step and maybe just put your general citizen voter hat on, is this a good process? Like, is this the way, you know, like a good way for trillions of dollars to be spent or not spent for stuff that Americans need and or want?
That's such a difficult question. On one hand, no, because one of the strongest things about our political system is that making a law is really hard, which means that if you do make a law, it probably has really broad support. It probably has largely positive consequences for most people. On the other hand, a weakness, like the exact opposite of the coin, a weakness of our system is that we put a party in power and then we present them with a lawmaking process that makes it nearly impossible for them to do anything. And then we judge them for it on the back end.
Right. And then we feel kind of like, well, but there's a loophole. But why is all of this done on loopholes and in backroom deals?
Yeah. And so then I'm never sure. Like, on one hand, like, maybe there is some value in allowing a party to enact some of its program in a way that doesn't require getting support from the other side. But on the other hand, I really like that we have this robust system of checks and balances that doesn't allow anyone to really overstep or go too far, because that can lead to sort of, no, and I'm not talking about like passing like childcare, but like that can lead to dangerous situations where if one party is totally unfettered, sometimes they may pass things that truly are harmful for some citizens.
James Curry is a former congressional staffer. He's a professor of political science at the University of Utah, written a couple of books about Congress. The latest is called The Limits of Party, Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. Thanks a lot for walking us through this today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, why teachers are more likely to see anger in a Black student's expression and behavior, even when it's not anger that the child is expressing. Just ahead, eating fermented foods like kimchi and kombucha may do more for your gut than a high-fiber diet. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Julie Rose. How do you feel about kimchi, kombucha, kefir? Fermented foods like these, and even just regular yogurt, are known to boost good bacteria in your gut, which can in turn reduce inflammatory cells related to chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes. Stanford researchers have some of the most concrete evidence of this to date, and they have found that eating fermented is better for your gut than eating high fiber. Christopher Gardner is the director of nutrition studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center. He's a professor at Stanford, and he's with us now. Professor, welcome.
Hey, Julie. Thanks. Nice to be here.
When we talk about fermented foods, what exactly does that mean? What falls under that category?
Well, you know, lots of things fall under it, but not all of them provide live bacteria. So if you eat tempeh, that's a fermented soybean, you don't really get much because it's cooked. If you're going to drink wine, that's a fermented beverage, but you don't get any. If you're going to have sourdough bread, you wouldn't, because by the time you bake the bread, you kill off all the poor little bugs. But if you were to eat sauerkraut or kimchi, those are great sources of vegetables and fiber and live bacteria. Or if you were going to eat yogurt, that's always got some great lactobacillus in it, or drink kefir or kombucha. Those are about the five main things that we got our participants to consume during our research study.
And the fermentedness then is it's live bacteria, but always like specific kinds of bacteria?
It is. Okay. You can characterize them. So something like sauerkraut has rickettsialis and gut shots. I don't know if you've seen these gut shots you can get in a store. It's sort of the brine that came from some of these foods.
No, that's terrible. Just like you just drink the sauerkraut juice?
Yeah, it's just the juice. We have a lot of people around here who are paying a couple bucks for a gut shot,
man.
Or go to a farmer's market, or kefir or yogurt have lactobacillus.
Silicon Valley for you. Okay, so kefir, the dairy-based stuff has lactobacillus in it.
Yeah, and you'll see that. You sometimes will see on a package this thing, CFU, which means actually colony-forming units. And they have some ridiculous numbers like, oh, there's 20 million CFUs per tablespoon in this thing. And that's because bacteria are so small that there's really can be thousands or maybe even millions of bacteria in what you're eating.
But drinking. If I like leave a bottle of orange juice out on the counter for like a month, it's going to ferment. Is that also just like automatically good for me?
No. So it's a great question because it's a balance of the good and the bad bacteria, right? And so part of the interest in this whole field actually, Julie, has to have with our industrial society sort of being overly hygienic, fearing bacteria, sterilizing everything. And the partner that I work with, Justin Sonnenberg, and his wife, Erica Sonnenberg, they're both PhD microbiologists. They have this very clear theory that, you know, that has really deteriorated this fabulously healthy microbiome, which is the collection of bacteria in your gut, that we evolved with over thousands of years. They have some very cool studies with sort of hunter-gatherer tribes, intermediate type folks, and urban folks. And they see the healthy bacteria in guts disappearing from people as they get more hygienic and to, you know, so concerned about the bad bacteria that they're killing all the bacteria. So you're right not to drink that orange juice that went bad. You know, we have a good sense of, oh my God, that smells bad, that tastes bad, don't eat it. There is some great bacteria. Yogurt tastes pretty good. Kimchi, sauerkraut, kombucha, kefir. There's a tasty way to make it. Yeah.
How much fermented food did the participants in your study eat on a daily basis?
Okay, this is going to sound like a lot, but give me a minute to explain. 6 servings a day. And you have to imagine that as a scientist, we spend a lot of our time doing study design issues thinking, okay, this is going to be a fermented food study. There isn't an obvious answer how much you give them. Is it all fermented food all day long, every day? No, that'll never work. Once a week, that's not enough. So you start thinking maybe in caloric terms, and things like kimchi and sauerkraut really don't have a lot of calories in them. So you might get 35 or 50 calories from a half a cup, which is a serving, or a cup of yogurt. I can't remember if that's 1 or 2 servings. A bottle of kombucha that you'd go buy in the store, which doesn't have that many calories. Usually those are 16 ounces where I go. That's 2 servings. Mm. So if you just had 1 cup of sauerkraut, 2 servings, 1 cup of kimchi, that's 2 servings, and 1 bottle of kombucha, that could be like 250 calories, 300 calories. It wouldn't be like 10% of your calories, but technically it would be 6 servings a day.
Okay.
And that's actually what we targeted, which was pretty funny because the folks that we recruited pretty much habitually ate none or maybe 1 serving a day. So it was a big jump for them.
Okay. So, and for how long? How long did you have them on this fermented regime?
So we gave them 4 weeks to accommodate and try to ramp up. We called it our ramp up phase. And then for 6 weeks, they were expected to maintain that. And then we even had a fun 4-week period afterward where we said, we'd like to see if any of these effects stuck around. We'd like to measure you 4 weeks from now. But we told you it was only 4 weeks of ramp up and 6 weeks of doing it. So you can do whatever you want. Pretty fun to see that on average, 4 weeks after the whole thing was over, they were eating 3 servings a day after having been eating none.
Because they liked the taste, or they liked how it made them feel, or
it was a combination of both. I wouldn't say that everybody said they felt better. Some of this is sort of asymptomatic, or you're not really quite sure how you feel. But I actually really think they enjoyed the idea. There's really some cultural background to eating fermented foods. They've been around for long periods of time, especially when we didn't have refrigeration. This is one of the ways you actually stabilize the food, was to create fermented food with healthy bacteria. And they did like it. So they persisted in eating it.
And what did you measure that indicated how this was affecting them?
Okay, so this is pretty fun. So I'm a nutrition scientist, and my usual job is to coax people into eating different things and then monitoring how well they adhere to it. So my job had to do with all of that. And I've usually called myself a feeder and a bleeder because we have them go in for blood samples. So one of the things you can do with the blood samples, is, Julie, is you can look at markers of inflammation. And I will say at this point in time, inflammation in the medical world is a topic of tremendous interest, but not something you can go to your doc to get measured, right? You go for a clinic visit and they'll check your glucose and your blood pressure and your blood cholesterol, but they won't check your inflammation. So we actually use the blood samples to look at 90 different markers of inflammation.
And inflammation is tied to, I mentioned earlier, type 2 diabetes. But what, do you want a lot of inflammation or not a lot of inflammation in your blood?
Okay, great question. So you want a balance like many other things in life. So picture this. If you have a cut, if you just recently experienced a cut and you have a wound, you're going to have an inflammatory response to that, which is a good thing. You're going to send all kind of white cells there. All kinds of products or chemicals and molecules are going to be generated to heal that. And so actually, if you downregulated your inflammation and you didn't have an inflammatory response, you wouldn't heal.
Mm.
But what we found in the general public, in the U.S. anyway, is that they kind of have chronically elevated inflammation even when they don't have a wound. It's almost like internally their metabolism is wounded and they're in a hyperreactive state, which could lead to some deleterious metabolism. It could lead to blood clots that shouldn't have been blood clots. It could lead to clogging arteries. And so you could get microvascular problems like you would get with diabetes, heart disease problems, cancer problems. So really what you want is to maintain this inflammatory state that's great for responding to wound that you want to heal, but not overzealous.
And how did eating a lot of fermented foods then over the course of those 10 weeks, how did that affect inflammation levels in the blood?
So 20 of those 90 markers went down over the 6 weeks. Hmm. And I can't tell you which 20. Well, I could. I could give you some IL-6 and tumor necrosis factor.
But that's good, I guess. Like you wanted to see those go down.
It was really good. And interestingly, my partners, the microbiologists, the Sonnenbergs, kind of thought it was going to be the fiber that did this, because fiber feeds your microbiome. So I bet your listeners have heard of prebiotics and probiotics, but I bet not all of them could explain the difference. And I'll just take a minute here to say prebiotics is basically the name for fiber, which is things that's hydrated carbon molecules that you can't digest and absorb. So they all go to your colon. And when they go there, the bacteria living in your colon thrive off that fiber. It's fuel to them. It's like sugar to them. And then probiotics is the name that we give for things that actually have live bacteria, like the foods that we talked about. And they've been working with mice for a long time. And in all their mouse studies, it was really fiber that was the most helpful. And we gave this data over to my colleagues, and they said, did you mislabel this? We're seeing a really cool benefit in a group, but it's not the group that we thought it would be. Hmm. Kind of one of these examples where the animal model data didn't translate to the humans, and that's duh. Humans are different than animals. If you can imagine, all the animals in their cages kind of eat their own feces in some of those studies, and humans don't eat their own feces. So I'm not really surprised that we had a different result than they had in their mouse studies. And it was really cool to see that this fermented food had this benefit.
Okay, the benefit of lowering inflammation, which was also a signal that there were more good, happy bacteria being good and happy in your gut, because we know that the gut is an important component of what drives inflammation in the body, right? I know I'm oversimplifying that. But the other thing that you were measuring, too, was just like, what kinds of bacteria were in the gut and whether or not that became more diverse, right? So you were measuring people's feces, I presume, stool samples.
And stuff.
What did you find with the fermented the fermented diet, folks?
So this was really fascinating, because we actually went out and we were collecting diet data on the people in our study, and we went out and bought all the products that they said they were buying, the different types of yogurt and the different types of kombucha, and characterizing them. And we looked at all those different bugs, and then we looked at what was showing up in people's gut, and the new bugs that were showing up in their gut, only 5% of them were explained by the sauerkraut and the kimchi and the other things that they were eating. And so this is a signal that as you start to change the types of bacteria in your gut, it opens you up to maybe there were some at some kind of very low, undetectable level that suddenly in this new environment were thriving and having a better shot at some of the fiber that was coming down. So a really fun thing was that according to the paper that we reported and my microbiologist colleagues, 95% of the new bacteria that were appearing were not actually directly from the foods they were eating. Super cool.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the key pieces of this, Professor Gardner, as we kind of move towards wrapping this up, because there's so many different directions we could go, but one of the key pieces of this research that we've been discussing is that you had two groups that you were comparing, and one was doing the fermented food diet, and then this other group was doing the high-fiber diet, which has traditionally, as you explained, been considered the best for healthy gut microbes, because the healthy bacteria in your gut really, like, they feed on fiber, and that's what, you know, so that's what we've been encouraged to do. And so what, you know, how did the benefits differ between the high fiber group and the fermented food group?
So there were some benefits, and it's too hard to explain to the in 1 minute or two that we have left. But I'll tell you a fascinating sort of oversimplified conclusion that we came to this. So there weren't that many people in that group, 18, but they almost broke into three groups of six. And we characterized how diverse their microbiomes were in the beginning. So there's a very low diversity, high diversity, and in the middle. And the ones with high diversity to begin with actually lower their inflammatory markers and seem to do really well.
On fiber, meaning?
On fiber.
Okay, okay.
The ones, and they were getting 40 grams of fiber a day compared to 20 a day before they joined the study. The ones with low microbial diversity at the start of the study who doubled their fiber intake, they actually had a negative reaction and they had more inflammation. And we have to follow up on this with a further study, mm-hmm. Julie, but the idea would be, oh my God, if you have this depleted microbiome from living in this over-hygienic industrialized world, and then you start throwing a bunch of fiber into your body that goes to your colon, you're overwhelming this depleted microbiota and they have a hard time dealing with it and they react adversely. So you would want to have this very rich, healthy, diverse microbiome. So our next study that we're planning, just if you couldn't have guessed this already, is we thought we'd give people fermented food first, make sure their microbial diversity was high, and then give them the fiber to see if maybe that would have counteracted this thing where the high diversity folks who did well, their positive results got canceled by the low diversity folks who didn't do well. So there probably is benefit from fiber. We just need to dig a little deeper.
So do you think that I should lean more towards the fermented foods? Then a lot of people who haven't been eating a lot of fiber in their diet, and when doctors say eat more fiber, they're like, no way, because when I do that, it really wreaks havoc on my digestive system, and you've got constipation, or you've got gas, or you've got, you know, whatever. It's like unpleasant. They're like, fiber's the worst. I don't want to do that. But maybe I can go eat yogurt instead, and I'm going to get maybe more benefits.
So I think you'll get benefits from the fermented food. That's what we found. But I think the fiber could come later. I think if you're, some of those symptoms are immediate that you just talked about, and some of them are uncomfortable, I would experiment on yourself and say, okay, I've had a bad experience in the past. I'm going to try some fermented food, and then I'm going to add some fiber again later and see if this enriched microbiome that I think I've now developed will do a better job handling that fiber that I aspired to, but I wasn't really doing so well eating it because of the symptoms I was getting.
Is there any risk of eating too much fermented foods?
No. Didn't 6 servings a day sound like a lot?
It does sound like a lot. Like it would be really hard to go beyond that. So, but,
yeah.
Okay.
And what's 10% of your calories, 20% of your calories from fermented food, that would be hard to do and you would be fine.
Yogurt, kefir, even kombucha, I can sort of, I can get behind, but what's the best way to eat kimchi if you're not like at a Korean restaurant?
So, you know, there are so many kinds of kimchi. So it's like spices in India. You really can't get the same garam masala anywhere in India because everybody has their own kind. Kimchi is really very different in different parts of Asian culture. So I would just keep trying some. Some are very much spicier than others. So be a little open-minded. I get mine from the wise goat folks at the Palo Alto Farmers Market, and they have a purple cabbage kimchi, and they have some a lot more carrot than other people that I've seen in their kimchi, and isn't that spicy. So don't write off kimchi and say, oh, there's only one way to make it, and it's too spicy. No, no, no. Look around. There's a lot of ways to make kimchi.
Christopher Gardner is a professor at Stanford University. He's director of nutrition studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center. Thanks a lot for your time today. I appreciate it.
That was fun, Julie. Take care. Eat your fermented food.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, how teachers, parents, and police officers are prone to misinterpreting emotions in Black children. Thanks for tuning into Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. I'm Julie Rose. Some people are better at reading emotions than others, but multiple studies have found adults frequently perceive Black children as being angry when the child isn't actually angry. Researchers have called this racialized anger bias and explored how this problem could be especially difficult or harmful when it's a teacher or a police officer with the bias. Sherrick Hughes is one of those researchers. He's a professor of education at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's on the line. Professor Hughes, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Why is it important that adults are able to accurately read a child's emotions?
Well, we think our findings are just 3 things. First, these mistakes can have serious repercussions for Black children because anger begets anger. So in an example where a teacher sees an angry child or misperceives a child as angry, is more likely to issue a consequence to that child that's related to anger. And then the child may protest because it's unfair, because the child might say, well, I wasn't angry, didn't deserve this. And so it can escalate. It's one of the pieces we thought may help us explain some of the findings that Black children receive three times as many suspensions and expulsions as white children in schools. Second, it can affect how the child feels about their teacher and school in general. And then third, can impact a child's sense of self and sense of self-worth and belonging in school, which of course can have some serious consequences for their outcomes in a particular classroom or a particular school if it happens in multiple classrooms.
Would you describe an experiment that you've used to study this disconnect? How do you get at this?
So for our latest piece that was published in the journal Emotion, we coined the term that you mentioned, racialized anger bias, as a term that means essentially seeing anger where none exists and having a sort of racialized tone or racialization connected to that. So in our case, studying whether we see Black students angry as more often than white students, given the same or similar facial expressions. So we hired child actors to display six different emotions, and we had professionals who could make all six facial expressions on demand to work with the children until they were able to do so. Then we took short video clips and made sure each expression was showing the desired emotion and only that emotion. So we were really incredibly careful to ensure this, so no one could later say, well, maybe the child was only a little bit angry, or maybe they weren't. Mm. And then we showed these video clips, there were 72 of them, to the prospective teachers, or some call pre-service teachers, and asked them what they thought the children were feeling. And we did not show them the fullest expression because we knew that by third grade, the children are masking a lot of what they feel. So prospective teachers saw what they might actually see in the classroom. Again, very focused, very highly controlled.
What's an expression that a Black child, is there one particular emotion or expression that seemed most easily mistaken for anger when teachers looked at the Black child actors?
So we had the children to essentially, so first and foremost, I guess the one way to answer that question is, even for when Black children had a neutral facial expression, it was misinterpreted more often and statistically significantly more often as being angry.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so it's not possible. You don't think it's possible that anger looks different, that emotions look different on the face of a Black child compared to a white child? We're not dealing with a case of misinterpretation or cultural misunderstanding here.
Correct. From what we're finding, that they're, again, with the child actors that we hired and the making different emotional expressions that they made, we wanted to ensure that early on, before the pre-service teachers even saw them, that we had consensus on, you know, what is this facial expression? And yes, there have been, this is where we need continued research, as researchers always say, right? But you bring up a really great point. That's why we don't call one study a program of research.
Right? Yeah. Professor Hughes, were these only white teachers, teachers in training that were doing this, or did you find teachers of other races also were prone to misinterpreting or assigning anger to a Black child that didn't actually have an angry expression?
Yes, unfortunately, we did not yet have enough Black or biracial, even prospective teachers to assess whether being Black was a sort of protective factor against the sort of mainstream cultural messages that might lead one to this racialized anger bias.
Okay. So what you can say, at least from this latest study, is that white teachers were more inclined to assign anger to a Black child. And what do you think is going on there? Why would they why would the color of a child's skin affect the way a teacher assesses a facial expression?
It's interesting. You know, so, you know, there's another study that shows a similar effect with adult facial expressions. Another one by a former doctoral student of my colleague on this study, Dr. Amy Halberstadt, whose dissertation showed a similar effect with parents. There's a long history of Black people, males and females, girls and boys, you know, and again, more study needs to be done on people who are non-binary, of course, so and future studies, but that anger is often identified with Black people disproportionately. And there's a history of that. So even when they're not. So I think part of it, as we talked about, there's a systemic racism that we've many studies have discussed, particularly in recent history for us, the post George Floyd. Right. And there's been sort of persistence of anti-Blackness and that's goes across both media, print media, television media, and other studies that for people that are in those fields who do this. So part of it is it's something that it's hard to sort of overcome if it goes unchecked. And we also believe, we know that as individuals, we tend to believe that we're better at assigning what someone's emotion is than we actually are.
Right. So you've got those two sort of underlying biases in place, our like willingness to trust our gut when it comes to recognizing people's emotions, even when we're inaccurate. And the other one is that it sounds to me like you're saying that a white teacher who harbors no ill will toward children of color in his or her classroom, and in fact, you know, wants to make sure that they're not behaving in a way that perpetuates discrimination, could in fact have these racial biases because of the environment that they've they're swimming in. Is that fair to say?
That is fair. That we've.
And so, what do you do about that? I mean, what's a white teacher to do in a situation like that? How do you get at that if some of this is like is bigger than my own desires and views?
I think the good news for all the listeners is that one of the things our team believes is that teachers, as many others who work with the public, social workers, for example, are what one study calls chronic egalitarians. Like they're people who, as you alluded to, essentially not only want to do the right thing by students and then teach and be equitable with how they respond to students and students' emotions, but they are required to do so. They need to do so in order to ensure that all their children, and because we study elementary school, that all their children reach their highest potential. And so given that we have a group of people that hopefully, although there's some study there, there's a more recent study that suggests that teachers hold the same biases as the rest of us. But one of the things that they didn't necessarily go into was do teachers like social workers and others who work with the public tend to have more of this, again, this sort of egalitarian sort of beliefs, at least, even if they may not be acting upon those, or even if you may test them or pretest them as having some racial biases that are similar to the general public. So, of course, one of the things then, a first step is awareness. It's much easier in our society to become comfortable with our own biases and to essentially say we don't have any. That's more of a common thing that one might hear from adults, whether they're trained to be teachers or any other industries, to say, oh, well, you know, I don't have those biases. I was taught to treat everyone the same. Or, you know, the Bible says we're all the same, right? But I think deep down people know they don't look at everyone the same and treat everyone the same. But I think it's something that it's become taboo to which in a way is a good way. That it's become like we look. It's a negative thing to be accused of being biased, right, in public at least. But that's certainly for us, for those of us that are in education, it's really extremely important for us to have the awareness. The next step after awareness is, of course, for us to get the really type of in-depth education and training to help us to work on debiasing and unlearning, which can be a lifelong pursuit, right? I mean, as if we've learned these biases, as some argue, from birth to adulthood to becoming a professional, well, it may take the rest of our lives to begin to unlearn them, and part of that starts with recognizing, but there are also tools that we have to help.
What is, just very quickly, what is one of the exercises you do in debiasing a person?
Oh, one of the pieces I use is there's a methodology called autoethnography. And it's essentially a form of critical self-study. And it allows a person to really focus in on their biases. And usually I have my pre-service students, prospective teachers, to focus on one particular bias that they, you know, as we've worked through that close to the midterm of the semester, as we've had our conversations and they've worked through readings, including things written by other teachers, right? That
they make
that
themselves.
Now they have identified.
It sounds like they make themselves the focus of their study then, to really drill down on that particular bias.
It's very cathartic. And you would, when I first started using this with students back in 2004,
it sounds like it's a fascinating line of research. Thank you very much for your time. Sherrick Hughes is a professor of education at UNC Chapel Hill. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First, why Maine fishermen are trying their hand at farming scallops, which is notoriously expensive and time-consuming. Then, making salary information public has been touted as a way to close the pay gap for women and minorities, but it may actually backfire. Also, all those studies that say social media use causes depression and anxiety, well, most of them have a serious research design flaw. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for joining us. New England's famous fishing has become more erratic over the years. Lobster, cod, urchin, shrimp, scallop, and oyster populations have all declined. In some cases, like oysters, fishermen have become fish farmers, growing their own catch. But there can be environmental downsides to aquaculture. That's what fish farming is sometimes called. In the cold waters off Maine, there is an experiment underway to farm scallops. The nonprofit Hurricane Island Center for Science and Leadership is helping establish best practices for scallop farming. Phoebe Jakulek is the center's director of research, and she's with us now. Hello, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
What's going on with the fish and shellfish populations off the coast of New England? What pressures are they facing?
Well, that's a pretty big question. You know, I would say commercially, the biggest species that is really harvested out in the wild is the scallops. You know, we do have crab fisheries. We do have mussel fisheries. But there are a fair amount of aquaculture efforts for other shellfish, you know, specifically mussels, some clam aquaculture, and also oyster aquaculture. So, you know, as our climate continues to change here in the Gulf of Maine, we are, as many people have heard, warming faster than many other places in the world. Our waters are warming faster than many other places in the world. You know, that can have pretty intense implications for populations. Because
shellfish don't do well in warmer waters, or because it affects the food sources?
Good question. So a little bit of both. You know, it really depends upon the species. So for example, scallops, our species of scallop here up in New England, we have two species of scallop. One is the bay scallop that you found in slightly more southern New England waters, right around Rhode Island. You find them in Massachusetts. But up here in Maine, in our coastal waters, we really only have sea scallops. So sea scallops are a larger species of scallop. Bay scallops only get about, 2 to 3 inches. Our sea scallops can get quite large. People, say they get dinner plate size. So they get to be pretty big scallops. And they really like deep, colder water that, can really kind of support what they need in terms of getting food and flow and all that good stuff. So they don't do well in warmer waters.
Mm, okay. Let's establish something just quickly here. So scallops, the few times that I've had them at a restaurant, it's usually been like a little white disc that's kind of a firm flesh, and it's usually like cooked in butter or something really decadent like that. Is that what we're talking about? What does a scallop look like in the wild?
Really, really great question. So out here, we actually introduced people to live scallops for the first time in many of their lives. Most people do know exactly what you're talking about, kind of a little kind of white fleshy disc. And again, the larger scallops that you might be getting from the store, those are actually the sea scallops that we're talking about. Scallops in the wild, they have two shells. They're a bivalve. So they have two shells, kind of like, a clam or an oyster or a mussel. But scallops can actually swim. A lot of those other organisms become pretty sessile. But scallops maintain movement, which is wild. When you pick up a clam or an oyster, they're pretty, the term clamming up, right? They're pretty clammed up and they kind of close their shells. Scallops, when you hold a scallop, it is almost interacting with you, it seems. They have eye spots around the outside of their shell. It's actually part of their mantle and part of their other biology. You can see inside, you can see the meat inside, which is actually the muscle that allows the scallop to clap the shell open and closed. You can see the gonads inside, or the reproductive organs, and you can actually tell male from female just by looking inside the scallop and seeing either a red reproductive organ, which is a female, or a white reproductive organ, which is a male.
And how do they swim?
Yeah,
do they have
really surprising?
How do they swim? Do they have flippers or?
No,
fins
no,
or
they
something?
Actually do that by clapping their shell. And surprisingly, they swim forward. You kind of think similar to like a lobster. When a lobster kind of flaps its tail to get away from something, it goes backwards. But scallops can actually swim forward. We do some scallop dive surveys around the island to monitor our wild populations here. And I was going along a transect underwater at about 70 feet last week. And all of a sudden, there was a little quarter-sized scallop that came swimming up right beside me. It was almost like he was trying to keep up with me.
Wow. Yeah, I think I would be really shocked to see a bivalve with with shells on either side swimming next to me. Okay, so describe for me why it is that your organization is focusing on trying to figure out how to farm scallops.
Yeah, good question. So it started a number of years ago. We are actually interested in understanding impacts on scallops as a species, the scallop species as a whole. So we do grow scallops in a 3.2 acre aquaculture site off the north end of the island. And we do also monitor our wild populations around the island. Scallops are a very lucrative commercial species here in Maine. We're very unique in that our season for scallops is in the winter, for wild scallops is in the winter from about December till March or April until they close the fishery. And it's an inshore scallop fishery. And that means that the scallops live in very shallow water where people can go out just for a day and harvest scallops. And you can come back and you can eat scallops that have been caught that day here in Maine restaurants. So it's really a very fresh product. Like I said, they like that cold, deep water. I personally think scallops are just the most delicious and decadent thing when they're fresh out of the water. And so, it's financially, economically very important here for the coast of Maine.
Is wild fish. So it's only second to lobsters for Maine in terms of Maine fishing revenues.
In some years. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
But are there limits on how many wild scallops can be fished? Is that kind of part of why farmers?
Oh, yes. Yep. So, there are, it's called a rotational management. So there are different areas that are open in 1 year and then areas that are closed during that same year. And so those areas rotate. And so what the scallop farmers are really trying to do, they're not really actually trying to compete with the wild fishery. They're trying to create a new market. So most scallops that you see in the store, right, they are just those, the meats, right, or the muscle of the scallop, which is what we eat. Scallop aquaculturists are actually starting to create a market for the whole scallop. And so a lot of those are smaller scallops. In many other parts of the world, people actually eat the entire scallop. So
meaning,
in France or in Asia.
Meaning eating what? So not just the white muscle part.
Yep.
They eat, what else is there to eat?
So the same thing that you eat when you eat a clam or an oyster. You know, if you eat oysters, you're eating the whole animal, right? You're eating everything that comes along with that oyster, right?
Okay.
It gets shucked open in front of you. And so you're getting the muscle, you're getting the gonads, you're getting the gills, you're getting all the things. And so lots of other places in the world actually eat the whole muscle or the whole scallop. But we actually can't do that here. And this is the challenge for scallop aquaculturists, is that scallops actually in the rest of their body, not in the meat, they do retain toxins, basically better than other bivalves. So they don't release toxins that they filter out of their food as easily as other bivalves. So that's why we mostly eat the meat. So anyone that is selling the whole scallop, right? Like one of the farmers that was highlighted in the article that recently came out was Marston Brewer at Penn Bay Farm Scallops. He goes through rigorous testing of his product to be able to sell whole scallops.
Oh, okay. And that's an article in the New York Times that talked about this. Now, so you think that Americans in restaurants would want to eat the gonads and the whatever else, even if it is safe?
Interesting. Yeah, people do love that. And truthfully, you know, I've been on Marston's boat and, you know, had the whole scallop. He actually cooks it up right for you, right there on the boat for you, which is amazing. And, you know, it's really delicious. I've never had them anywhere else in the world, but people really do find that a delicacy in other places of the world. You know, I was reading some of the comments in the New York Times article, and there were lots of people that referenced eating them in France. And they really love the coral, which is, you know, the reproductive part, what people often refer to as the female gonad because it's red. So I think that that's really the goal, is educating people about the opportunities that eating the whole animal can kind of offer, and creating a market around that, which is not an easy task. It's a lot of work.
Right. So Phoebe Jekyllek, the idea is to create a market, but also to in some way, does this do anything for the wild population? Is it potentially harmful? I guess we should talk about the fact that in some cases, aquaculture actually has a bigger, you know, it has its own downsides. For example, fish farming, you have to feed the fish something. And a lot of times what happens is that there's like overfishing of other smaller fish species in the wild in order to create all of the fish feed to feed the farmed fish. And so you're kind of like not winning. What are the environmental consequences of farming scallops?
Great question. You know, that's actually one of the benefits of shellfish aquaculture, is that most of it really takes place in open ocean. And you are not feeding shellfish anything. They are filter feeders. So they're actually just, you know, sucking water through their system, and they're filtering out the things that already live in the water, like small plankton, phytoplankton, and zooplankton. And so they're feeding themselves. And, you know, there is structure that goes into the water. An interesting thing around here, of course, is we have the lobster fishery. A lot of the farmers that are doing scallop aquaculture, they work within kind of understanding the lobster fishery and, you know, really try not to impact the accessibility of that fishery either. So a lot of the farms are underwater. The nets that scallops are grown in actually hang on, they hang off of horizontal lines that are deployed about 20, 25 feet below the surface of the water. So the only thing that you see on the surface are a couple of marker buoys on either end of that line. And other kinds of shellfish farms, and, you know, there's not a lot of research that's been done on scallop aquaculture here in the United States because it's really just getting started. But, you know, there is evidence from other farms that, you know, structure from aquaculture farms increases the abundance and biodiversity of existing species. So
because it becomes a habitat. So a habitat for oysters can also become a habitat for other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Or, okay. you know, other organisms, other fish or, you know, other orgs might be eating the biofouling organisms. So the organisms that grow on that structure that's underwater, you know, lots of different kinds of seaweed can settle. Other invertebrates can settle. So yeah, there's a lot of opportunity there. And we're actually working to understand how farms, scallop aquaculture farms, might enhance larval supply to the wild population.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so I want to talk about that. But first, if the scallops are just out there in the wild, the farmed scallops are eating the food that's just available in the water. Is there enough of that food to go around, or are they going to be crowding out the wild scallops who are also trying to eat that food in the water?
Really, really, really good question. So what's interesting, and that would actually be a really great study, right? You just came up with a scientific question right there, Julie. you know, so there's, like I said, there's not a lot of research kind of comparing aquaculture and wild populations. What we do know is that they do inhabit two different areas of the ocean. So our wild scallops grow up on the bottom in deep, you know, darker water. I mean, anywhere really from 40 feet and below, you can find them shallower, but they like that. They like deeper water and they like to be on sandy, kind of sandy bottom habitats, some shell hash bottom habitats. Scallop aquaculture is grown, like I said, up in the water column. So these scallops are really being grown 25, 30 feet below the surface. And the
on hanging nets.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. So they're up in the water column. And so they could potentially be getting different food sources. They could be getting different flow. They could have access to different light levels, you know, all of those things, you know, different throughout the water column, light levels, nutrients, flow, that all also influences, you know, phytoplankton and zooplankton activity. And so, you know, they really may be kind of sourcing from two different areas, but you know, that's really not been looked at very much.
But you are also creating a new habitat, which could be having a rippling effect then on other stuff that lives in the water column.
Yeah, you could. You know, there are, I mean, that is a problem for the farmers, is that there are species that do, you know, they distribute their larvae in the water. You know, many invertebrate larvae have a planktonic life stage. So they do sometimes set on aquaculture gear, you know, mussels sometimes set on aquaculture gear, barnacles set on aquaculture gear, you know, and so that can really be a kind of a labor issue on the farms.
And then you also mentioned that you think it's possible that these farmed scallops might actually be helping to populate the wild scallop areas as well.
Yeah.
How would that happen?
So scallops, like other invertebrates, are what are called broadcast spawners. So they actually just shoot their gametes or their eggs and sperm up into the water column, and they hope for the best and hope that they meet. You know, so scallops and you know, urchins also do this. They kind of aggregate. When they're getting ready to spawn and ready to reproduce, they try and find each other. So they kind of aggregate and get closer to each other to increase the chances that egg and sperm are going to meet. So we're essentially creating that for scallops on farms. You know, each net, when scallops are larger, they have about 40 scallops per net. And some, you know, some farms can have upwards of 60, 100,000 scallops on them. Mm-hmm. So we have these very large populations, these large densities of scallops. And if we're putting them in these large densities, which they're trying to do in the natural environment anyway, in order to reproduce, we could be seeing increased fertilization success, which then would translate into increased larval supply in the long run. But that's yet to be determined. And that's some of the work that we're working on in the future.
But are these the same kinds of scallops? And are they as genetically desirable as the wild scallops?
Really great question. So there is no hatchery for scallops here in the United States. We do not have a sea scallop hatchery.
Where a farmer could go and like buy some scallops to start his farm.
Yep. Okay. Right. Exactly. So farmers actually get their seed from the wild population. You can catch them in what are called spat bags. And so, like I said, the scallops is the first part of their life cycle. They really spend in the plankton. So they spend as, you know, kind of drifting in the ocean currents. Right. And so you can deploy what are called spat bags, and the scallops actually settle inside the bags. And then that's how you get your seed or your spat to start your farm. So we are getting our scallops right from the wild population. So there is no kind of selective breeding yet for any scallops because there is no hatchery.
Okay.
And that could actually be another benefit and is another great question. You know, what are the impacts of genetic diversity of farming scallops, you know, between wild and cultured populations?
Phoebe Ducklack, if scallops are so desirable and lucrative as a fishing product, why isn't there a lot of scallop farming already going on?
Really good question. So one, you know, one bottleneck that is kind of seen is that there is no hatchery. So, you know, because it is dependent on a wild set, you know, that is a little bit of a guessing game where you can catch the most scallops. So there's not a consistent seed supply from year to year, although the folks that are doing it here are catching the seed. It is labor intensive. You know, there are, like I said, some farms have, you know, tens of thousands of scallops on them. That's a lot of nets, you know, and that's a lot of labor. And if you are not already set up with your own fishing boat or your own gear, you know, it can be a big upfront investment, you know, and that market is also still developing. Like I said, they've been trying to develop that whole scallop market and just educate people about aquaculture scallops as an alternative during the seasons when, you know, our local Maine scallops are not available. You know, you can also buy meats and not just the whole scallop.
And how long does it take for a scallop to mature to where you can, you know, harvest it?
So for that smaller, that whole market or that whole scallop market, those are of smaller size, about 2 to 2.5 inches. For a larger meat product, you're going to grow it for about 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
But there is also, you know, bay scallops are a smaller meat. So you can also, you know, grow them to a smaller size and kind of get a quicker product that way. Mm. And so
speaking with Phoebe Jekyllek, it looks like we just lost her there. She's director of research at Hurricane Island Center for Science and Leadership in Maine, working on some early scallop farming efforts off the coast of Maine. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 20 minutes, although studies that say social media causes depression and anxiety, well, most of them have a serious research design flaw. We'll hear what that is. Just ahead, making salary information public has been touted as a way to close the pay gap for women and minorities, but it may actually backfire. I'm Julie Rose. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. If companies have to disclose how much they pay their employees, that should make compensation more fair, shouldn't it? It would be harder for a company to get away with paying a woman or a person of color less for doing the same work that a man does, a white man. Well, that's the thinking, at least, behind pay transparency laws that about half of states have adopted. But since those laws took effect, wages in the private sector in those states have actually declined a bit. They've gone down. Does pay transparency actually hurt the workers it's supposed to help? Harvard Business School professor Zoe Cullen has looked at this closely. She's a labor economist and with us now. Professor Cullen, thanks for taking time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Would you describe what the typical pay transparency law does or requires in the United States?
Sure. So one type of pay transparency law, and the one that is the topic of the research we'll discuss, is policies that prevent an employer from retaliating against a worker who shares information with their coworker about their own wages or inquires from another worker to have that information. And typically the way you might prevent an employer from retaliating is through the court system. And many of these laws have especially high punitive damages for employers who either fire a worker who does such a thing or retaliates in a number of ways.
Okay, so if the law only prevents the employer from retaliating, it doesn't require that they post somewhere publicly, this is how much every person in the company makes, right? They're not doing like a salary listing of their employees. Are the employees even talking or sharing? It's kind of a taboo thing to tell your coworker what you earn. Like, I almost don't want to know what you make next to me because I don't know how I'm going to feel about that.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's a very hard thing to measure because, of course, these things are quite private. They're typically exchanged in corners of the workplace or outside of the workplace that are not being monitored. And in fact, you know, to see something like this, we rely on surveys that happened at repeated cross-sections in time. Typically, those surveys will ask something of an employee, such as, does your employer have an official non-disclosure policy pertaining to salary information? And we've seen that in the states that pass these laws, the rate at which employees report these formal non-disclosure policies goes down a lot more quickly than in the states where these laws haven't been passed. Mm. So that's one piece of evidence. And the other is what journalists, fantastic journalists, have done to sort of pull together typically anonymous Google spreadsheets that have been shared among employees in various companies, suggesting that that's the one popular way that the information spreads.
So it's your belief that when one of these laws takes effect, that there is more sharing among employees of their salary,
yeah,
that there's
right.
more general knowledge, at least, of kind of what roughly your peers are making.
That's right. And that part's very hard to quantify. So the way we'll study it is by looking at things that are measured well, such as wages and employment. Mm.
And so in this case, then, you looked for a period of about 10 years from 2004 to, let's see, 2000 to 2016, so actually 15 years, you looked to see what happened to wages overall in sectors where pay transparency took place. Is that correct?
Yes. So that's the right way of thinking about it. And I think there's sort of a short-term and a medium-term effect that we can talk about separately.
Yeah. Well, tell us, first of all, what you saw. I mean, the idea was, talk to me about what the assumption might have been. What was the idea, the theory behind passing a pay transparency law?
Yeah. So many people, when they think about pay transparency, have what I think of as the initial reveal effect, so the short-term effect in mind. And it's something that I think you even spoke about as you introduced the topic, which is that when we find out what our coworkers are making, suddenly those of us who are perhaps earning less than our colleagues might use that information to negotiate a raise and equalize pay. Mm-hmm. And so that would lead to typically higher wages on average, and especially higher wages for people at the lower end of the income distribution. Mm.
And did you see that happening?
So let me, if you don't mind, tell you both the short-term and the medium effect, because in fact, we only really get to see what happens in the case that employers respond. So the short-term effect is a case where the employer doesn't anticipate the transparency. So imagine, you know, the policy is passed, and overnight we are able to start discussing it a lot more than we previously were. And that's a case where the employers didn't respond by changing what wages they negotiate to begin with or their wage-setting policies at the firm at large. But
in that case, then, it is just a situation of an employee gets wind that her coworker is making X amount more than she is for the same job. And so she goes to her manager and says, you know, what's the deal? I deserve more. And so it's like a case by case basis rather than the company kind of instituting a new salary policy.
Exactly. So if we could see it at a really granular measure, so month by month, what happens to negotiations, we would expect that initially there would be a boost in wages.
Mm-hmm.
And then
at least for the people who are on the lower end, you know, so more of like an equalizing.
Exactly.
Okay.
But in most of these states, these laws didn't happen overnight. So employers had some chance to see them coming. And by the time that they are instituted, employers have a chance to basically reconsider what wages they want to pay various people.
Mm.
And as you can sort of see from the description of what happens, it becomes the case, and it wasn't before, that if an employer raises the wage of someone, especially at the top end of the distribution, that increase in wage can have an effect on everybody else's negotiations.
Okay, so describe for me what you think, because you actually found that overall wages went down about 2% on average in these states at private companies that were subject to these laws. And so what do you think was happening there? Were they Was it just that the higher paid people weren't getting as many raises because everybody already knew they were at the top of the spectrum, but the lower paid people were kind of coming up closer to sort of meet that higher rate?
So that's great intuition that you have, and the 2% is certainly an average number. So you should think about how an employer, and I think your intuition is probably what many employers thought about, just sort of if we continue to make raises at the very top end, those raises are going to really have a big effect on what we have to pay people in the middle and the bottom of the wage distribution. And so there's a strong incentive, much stronger incentive for employers to bargain very aggressively, and in particular bargain aggressively at the top of the earners' profiles. And then
to keep wages sort of level there, to like not do a lot of raises.
Exactly right. To basically anticipate and mediate what's going to happen when workers start talking to each other.
Right. And what happens to the bargaining power or the demands that an individual worker can make if it's generally known how much the top earner and the bottom earner is making in a company?
Yeah, well, so think about the very extreme case where we were all basically completely privy to information about everybody else. So we just knew the moment we entered the firm what everyone else was making. Mm. That's equivalent. And on top of that, you know, we felt that, you know, it was very informative about what we ourselves could ask for. So that, you know, under equal pay laws, if we saw someone doing the same job as us earning more, we thought for sure we could ask for that amount.
Mm-hmm.
And in such a case, under full transparency, what happens is that the employer is essentially picking a price that everyone can see for the job. And that is actually quite a strong bargaining position to be in, because the employer, you can think of them as effectively saying, well, if you don't take this particular wage, I can't raise your wage. If I were to do that, I have to raise everybody's wage. And that becomes a very strong commitment device for an employer to basically pick a price and stick to it.
Oh, it becomes not negotiable. So when you start your job, where everybody knows that you're supposed to negotiate your salary when you start a new job, this is especially for new workers into a company, if there's pay transparency, it's kind of like, this is the job. This is what you make. It's the list price. Take it or leave it.
Exactly, exactly. And you see a lot more of that happening. You know, we've seen it, of course, in the public sector across the U.S. For many state employees, this is already the case that the, you know, salaries are basically public information on a website. Mm. In many positions in Europe, it's a lot more common for wages to be essentially a posted price or take it or leave it offer, you might say, of this nature. And we do sort of on average see those wages decline relative to, you know, traditional private sector jobs where everything is private.
So who wins and who loses among the employees, though? Because if what you used to have was a secret but pretty unequal system where you had some people doing the exact same job making a lot less than another person, and if that happened to be a woman or a person of color, you know, that would fit a pattern that we're familiar with in this country. So if you no longer have that, the company is spending the same amount of money on labor. They're just sort of paying a lot more equal salaries, or have they somehow figured out how to pay less in total for their salaries?
Yeah. So what we've found theoretically and empirically is that on average, the employers are paying a lower wage bill overall. But you're totally right that it does not mean wages are lower for everybody.
Mm.
And in particular, people who, and we know that on average it's true of minorities and women who are going to be on the lower end, can see pay rises. So the overall wage bill can go down and average wages can be lower, but it can still be quite beneficial for both equality and for lower earners.
Mm. If you're in an economy where all of your competition is in a pay transparency system, so your competitors know how much you're paying your engineers, and you know how much they're paying their engineers, I could see there would be, on the one hand, a temptation for kind of price fixing, for everyone to sort of just agree that this is what we're going to pay our engineers, kind of roughly, you know, since we have to tell everybody what our list price is. Mm-hmm. I mean, what other way is there to be competitive, you know, to compete against to make yourself attractive as a company if you can't compete on wage?
you know, that you ask a very interesting and important question. I don't think we know the answer quite to that question you're asking, which is sort of it, if firms were forced to basically or encouraged or chose to be publicly visible about their wages with other competitors, what would happen? Would they coordinate around a wage with their competitors, and would that become sticky, or would they put more competitive pressure on the market to raise wages? It's an open question, Julie.
Okay. Professor Cullen, part of what you talk about in this research is sort of who has the leverage, who has more power in the negotiation, and pay transparency turns out to, in the long run at least, give the employee, especially the new employee at a company, less bargaining power. Is that right? Am I getting that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And and what happens in a case where those negotiations happen through a union?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked this, because the premise of the model that I described to you and also the empirics so far have been really focused on parts of the labor market where individuals are bargaining. And as an individual, you know, under full pay secrecy, you use your personal information and your outside options and your own negotiation skills to really push for yourself. And that's the case where introducing transparency will have both an equalizing effect on wages and also shift bargaining power away from individual workers. But in the case of a
right, because and just to clarify, because the prospective employer or the manager can just say, well, you know, I can't pay you more than I'm paying all the other people who do this job. This is the way we pay. Everybody knows this. The end.
Exactly. But when under a collective bargaining agreement, individual workers really weren't able to negotiate as individuals and use their own information and private outside options in that process. So, in fact, if you think about a union as first negotiating with the employer on behalf of all the workers to sort of fix a wage schedule or wage range, they're going to basically preempt what impact transparency policy might have on bargaining power of individuals.
Okay, preempt meaning that it turns out to be better for, like, salaries are likely to end up higher if a union has been involved, because a union is engaged at the level of saying, this is what we want the wage range to be for this job and for this job.
What I can speak to is not necessarily the comparison between wages within a union and outside of a union.
Okay.
But what I can say is that the impact of transparency on the wages of a unionized workplace are much, much smaller. They're not only smaller from the, you know, from the perspective of shifting bargaining power and lowering average wages, but they shift wages much less in general.
How could a pay transparency law be designed that would result in higher wages for employees, more bargaining power for employees to get what they
Yeah, it's a very interesting question to ask indeed. And I don't have a solid answer for you. In fact, I think for most of the work I've done, I've been able to extend the results to many different forms of pay transparency policy. So we've seen in the UK and other European countries an attempt to publish, say, just the pay gap between men and women, or just the pay between the median earner and the CEO. And typically these will also have a similar effect as the one that I described. So in general, if the transparency policy has this this feature where it creates information about what the employer might be willing to pay a worker, so, you know, if you learn about the pay gap between a male and a female, if it gives you some indication of what you might be able to ask for yourself, that is the type of information that puts pressure on an employer to really take a strong and aggressive bargaining position.
It really just depends on what your goal is then. So if your goal is to see higher wages for workers across the board, pay transparency laws are not the way to go. If your goal is to see more equalization, fewer gaps between male and female or white and minority, then pay transparency laws can get you some of that way.
That's exactly right.
Zoe Cohen is a professor of economics at Harvard Business School. Thanks a lot for taking time today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, all those studies that say social media causes depression and anxiety and increases risk of suicide. Well, a lot of those studies have a serious research design flaw. We'll find out what it is. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind today. I'm Julie Rose. There is a popular belief shared by a lot of social scientists that more time spent on social media and smartphones correlates to worse mental health, especially in young people. And a lot of scientific studies published in reputable scientific journals have borne this out. But social worker and psychiatry researcher Craig Sewell says most of these studies contain a fatal flaw that undermines the whole premise of social media causing depression and anxiety. Sewell is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Pittsburgh, and we read about his work in an article he wrote recently for the Conversation website. We've got him on the line. Dr. Sewell, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
What exactly is the issue, the fatal flaw in the design of this research that often links technology and poor mental health?
Well, admittedly, it's not a sexy topic. It has to do with measurement. And measurement, although it is the bedrock of many scientific studies, tend to be overlooked, unfortunately. And digital media use studies is unfortunately no exception to that. So the vast majority of studies that have tried to examine the potential link between something like social media or smartphone use and well-being, like depression or anxiety or suicidality, have relied on so-called self-report measures to try to track people's social media use or smartphone use, essentially by asking, for example, in the past week, how often have you used social media? Or for what amount of time do you use social media on average in the past month? So this is a common way of asking people questions in the social sciences. However, when it comes to something that is observable, like a behavior like social media use, where we have existing behavioral trackers, like the Screen Time application that comes ready-made on all Apple iPhones these days that automatically tracks how much time you spend on various devices or applications, we have a good sense of sort of the ground truth. Those measures aren't perfect. No measure is, but it gives a better sense of how much time people actually are spending on these devices.
Let me just interject. So if the problem is that we're relying on people to report how much time they spent on their phones or on social media, aren't most people likely to underestimate? So if the study finds that people who spend, that people generally are spending X amount of time on social media and that also correlates to depression, it seems like the correlation would be even stronger if you actually measured it, because people probably said they only spend 10 hours a week on social media when in fact they spent 20 hours, because we all underestimate how much time we lose to these kinds of apps.
Right. I would say that on average, people tend to underestimate their social media use, whether it's because of a social desirability bias. They don't want to believe that they spend that much time on their devices. Hmm. There are people that might also overestimate, but the main finding in some research that I've done recently is that the error or the inaccuracy in these self-reports is actually related to things like how depressed a person is or how much time they spend on their devices. So in other words, someone that's more depressed is more likely to give an inaccurate self-report of how much time they're spending on social media. Also, people that use their devices more or social media more are also more likely to give an inaccurate report of how much time they spend online. So that's crucial, because all of these studies that where we're trying to figure out if this is, if digital media is having an impact on well-being, those are the very variables that we're trying to investigate the association. So if I'm looking at the link between social media and depression, and depressed people are more likely to give inaccurate responses, it's a bit like if we had people self-diagnose themselves with COVID-19, and those with COVID are more likely to inaccurately diagnose themselves.
Mm. Which means what for all of these studies that have asked people how much they use digital media and correlated that with mental health? It means that there's just simply no validity to any of those findings? Does it mean that they were asking the wrong question? Does it mean that the connection just isn't as strong as we thought, but it's still there?
Well, I would say it's safe to question the validity of studies using, trying to quantify how much time someone spends online or on social media with self-reports. You know, self-reports come in a lot of different shapes and forms. So if someone is asking, did you spend time on your phone today? Yes, no. Someone's probably pretty accurate at that, but that's mm-hmm. not the type of questions that they tend to get asked. And so I think we have to apply a skeptical eye to many of these studies and try to introduce more rigorous methods that if we're trying to quantify how much time someone spends online and whether that's related to their depression, and we have potential policies or interventions based on these studies, we really need to make sure that we're measuring what we think we measure. Because in my own work, I found that when you look at the correlation between self-reported social media and depression, the correlation or the association is stronger when you use self-reports than when you use an objective tracker like the Screen Time app.
Oh, okay. So there is a pretty straightforward fix to this, which is available now because of this Screen Time tracker on iPhones. A researcher could replicate the research, do the exact same thing, but instead of asking people to self-report, just look at the Screen Time data to know exactly how many minutes a person spent on social media over the last week. And when you do that, you say you find less of a link between social media use and depression?
That's what I found in my research. I found that the association between self-reported social media use and smartphone use was stronger with depression than if you used an objective measure.
Huh. But still you find, I mean, are you arguing that social media and smartphone use are great for a person's mental health? Like they have no effect?
No, I just think that we can't put the cart before the horse. Fortunately, you know, we've been doing research, this association, what I mean, you know, digital media and well-being for a decade and a half. But because most of those studies relied on self-reports, it's hard to know for certain how trustworthy those results are, especially if we want to build policies or enact legislation that has to do with limiting someone's time they spend online.
So you come down then on the side of the link is inconclusive at this point. Need more information, which is also the side that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has taken, comes down
right,
on, you know, when he's like at a congressional hearing. And that doesn't go over very well with policymakers who are like, okay, but I know young people who are clearly suffering, because of the way that they're comparing themselves to other people, because of the unrealistic expectations or the unrealistic, you know, lives and like FOMO and all this stuff that
sure.
comes at them through Instagram or TikTok or whatever, you know,
yep.
social media they're using. I mean, on a fundamental level, there's like, it just makes sense that if you spend a ton of time on social media where people are thumbs up, you know, making quick snap judgments based on how someone presents themselves, that that's going to be hard, especially for a young person's self-esteem.
Absolutely. I agree. I think it is a very complicated subject and a very complicated phenomenon. And these measures are very general. They are trying to quantify how much time you spent or the frequency with which you check in on a certain social media app. But really, we line with more detailed or more nuanced studies that are asking people, what specifically are you using social media for? Mm. With whom are you interacting? Why? What are you hoping to get out of it? We find that there's a wide range of affordances of why people are using it. And if there's a mismatch between why someone is using it, say, for example, to connect with others, but they're getting cyberbullied instead, that's going to have negative impacts on their well-being. But if they're using it to finding that positive impacts on their well-being. And so it's a more having a, the field is starting to move, the field of digital starting to move toward, okay, we need to look at how people are using it. Look at more specific uses.
Professor Sewell, you cut out there on us just briefly. What is a situation where social media might actually be having a positive effect on a person's mental health or sense of well-being?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
No problem. We're having a little bit of a connection problem, but you cut out on us briefly when you were explaining a situation where social media use might have a positive effect on a person's mental health. What is a situation? Give me an example of that. Looks like we're having trouble with that.
I think a situation where...
Please go ahead.
I think a situation where someone, where social media could have a positive effect is if they are otherwise maybe isolated from a community and they find socializing in person particularly difficult. They might be able to find friends online and people with whom to find a community that they can get a sense of belonging and friendship and those sorts of things. So I think we can find positives in our use of social media, but there's definitely, you know, ways that, like cyberbullying, that it can have unintended impacts, you know, because no one is going online to with the intention of getting cyberbullied.
Why did you get interested in this topic?
Good question. It's interesting that I'm in this place where I'm saying, you know, I think we need, the data are inconclusive or this link is inconclusive. And I find that I'm, you know, agreeing with Mark Zuckerberg, unfortunately. And because I went into my PhD studies as a result of being a clinician, a mental health clinician at a college counseling center where I was meeting with young people. And I found anecdotally that it seemed like the devices that people were using and the apps that they were using were having a negative impact on their well-being. And so I actually went in with this assumption that social media was bad for people. And as I dove into the data and read the studies and learned more about how to critique studies and some of the drawbacks of many of the much of the work in this area, I found that it's much more complicated than the picture that is typically presented in the popular media. And it's often an easy thing to scapegoat for many of the, you know, sort of ills or problems that we see in society, and that we just need to make sure that we understand this phenomenon much better and more robustly before we make potentially strong interventions or policies.
Craig Sewell is a social worker and postdoctoral scholar of child and adolescent mental health at the University of Pittsburgh. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for our show today. It's been great having you along. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Raymond produced the show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. We are at BYU Top of Mind. And you can listen on demand by subscribing to our podcast. Just look for Top of Mind on your favorite podcast app or ask your smart speaker to play the Top of Mind podcast. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.